Beulah had wallpapered Hank's new walls with floppy pink cabbage roses and painted the ceiling and wainscoting a matching pink. She painted the plywood floor pink, too, but discovered the problem with that when the first rainy day arrived and she had to get out the mop. So she spattered the pink with yellow, blue, and purple and put a purple rug in front of the door. Then she put a sign out front, and she and Bettina Higgins, her beauty associate, tied on their pink ruffled salon aprons and picked up their combs and scissors. They had a vital mission. They were dedicated to making all darling women beautiful, one head of hair at a time. Beulah looked forward to Mondays because most of her Monday customers were dahlias. They would share their weekend news and brighten one another's day with little bits of this and that. They agreed with Beulah that even a little beauty, a smile, a helping hand, bright marigolds along a walk, pink roses blooming beside an old house, goes a long way toward making people happy in this gritty, grimy old world. And if not happy, then perhaps a little easier to live with, which is important when bad things happen to good people and everybody finds themselves scrambling to get by. Among the dahlias who had standing appointments on Mondays was Verna Tidwell. Verna always came at 8 because she had to be on the job at the courthouse at 9, and she liked to get her hair out of the way early. Bessie Bloodworth and Aunt Hetty Little both came in at 8:30, which was not a problem, because Bessie liked to have Bettina do her. After that, Erlynn Biddle came at 9 and Mildred Kilgore at 10. By that time, Beulah would have caught up with most of the weekend news and was ready to face the week well-informed. The bell over the door dinged, and Beulah looked up, expecting Bettina, who could always be counted on getting to work before the first appointment. But it was Verna, dressed fit to kill in her best gray gabardine suit, a red blouse, red pumps, and the jaunty red felt newsboy hat that Fanny Champagne had made for her. Verna had 2 jobs. She was the county treasurer and the county probate clerk, so she always tried to look nice. But this was unusual. "My gracious," Beulah said admiringly. "Don't we look swell this morning? Special occasion?" Verna took off her cap and jacket and hung it on the rack by the door. "I'm driving over to Monroeville to have lunch with some ladies. They have a Girl Scout troop over there, you know." Shaking her head to Beulah's offer of a cup of fresh-brewed coffee and an oatmeal cookie, she sat down in the shampoo chair and put her head back in the sink. "No, I didn't know," Beulah said, taking the cap off the shampoo bottle. "You're interested in Girl Scouts?" She ran the water, making sure it was hot, the way Verna liked it. "I've always wished that Spoonie could be a Girl Scout." She fluffed up Verna's brown hair, testing it with her fingers. "You're a little dry, sweetie. When we've got you shampooed, I'll use some of my special hair conditioner." Verna wore her brown hair in a sleek bob with square-cut bangs, like that flapper movie queen Louise Brooks. The style was a little out of date. These days, hair was all fluffy curls, a la Katharine Hepburn and Norma Shearer. But the bob was a perfect fit for Verna's no-nonsense, get-straight-to-the-point style, so Beulah suggested she keep it. "Whatever you say, Beulah. Where hair is concerned, you're the boss." Verna closed her eyes as Beulah went to work. "Well, maybe she can," she said after a moment. "Spoonie, I mean. Be a scout. I'm thinking about starting a troop here in Darling."
"Oh, really?"
Beulah began to massage the shampoo through Verna's hair. "That is an absolutely swell idea, Verna. And with your organizing ability, you're just the person to do it, too." "Well, I don't know," Verna said slowly. "There are some old fogies in this town that don't like the idea, you know." Her voice became mocking. "Girls getting out there hiking, having adventures, coming up with new ideas. Why, that's what boys are supposed to do. It's downright immoral, that's what it is. Dangerous, too." Beulah chuckled and shook her head. "Well, yes, I suppose some folks do think it's immoral when a girl gets a new idea. My mother truly thought it was a scandal that I would go off to Montgomery on the Greyhound all by myself and get my beauty certificate and start up my own business. And there are plenty who still don't think women should have the vote." Which was true. Although women had been voting for president since 1920, they were blamed unfairly for Harding, Coolidge, Hoover, and now Roosevelt. She turned on the faucet again and began to rinse Verna's hair.
But if you start a troop here, darling Verna, I will personally see to it that Spoonie is right there for every meeting, and her friends, too.
Thank you, Beulah, Verna said gratefully. That will be a big help, but I've got a lot to learn before I get started on this project, so don't say anything to Spoonie about it just yet.
Oh, I won't, Beulah said.
But whenever you want some help, you be sure and let me know. If there's a thing in this world I believe in, it's girls.
She took down a bottle of her freshly made special recipe hair conditioner, one egg yolk whisked in a cup of warm water with a teaspoon of cottonseed oil, and poured a generous amount over Verna's hair. She was working it in when the telephone rang, three quick shorts, the Bowers telephone signal, and since Bettina still hadn't come in, Beulah had to hurriedly dry her hands and go to the phone. The call was from Alice Ann Walker, another Dahlia. Alice Ann always took an 11 o'clock lunch hour on Mondays. Today she had to reschedule because Mr. Duffy, her boss at the Darling Bank, was gone for the day and she couldn't get away. In a moment, Beulah had her fingers back in Verna's hair.
Three shorts, Verna said. You're back on the party line?
Afraid so, Beulah sighed. Myra May says she had to put us back on the party line until they get a new switchboard at the exchange. She made a clucking sound. It's a serious problem for poor old Mrs. Hubbard across the street. She's losing her hearing, and she confuses her ring, two shorts and a long, with ours. She's always running to answer our calls.
Huh, Verna muttered. Maybe she just likes to listen in.
I have the same problem on my party line. Eudora Crawford keeps her telephone beside her chair and picks up every time it rings, no matter who it's for. I have to tell her to hang up and then listen to make sure she does. She puffed out an irritated breath. I've been trying to get a private line, but Myra May tells me the same thing. Darling obviously needs a new switchboard.
Verna was getting so worked up that Beulah thought it was time to change the subject. While she was rinsing out the conditioner, she said,
We had an exciting weekend at our house. My Hank got lucky.
She chuckled at her own little joke.
He got picked to sing lead with the Lucky Four Clovers.
He did?
Verna's eyes popped open.
What happened to Mr. Ewing? He was singing lead when the quartet put on their show Friday night.
He was, but he's been suffering with pimples in his throat, and they've gotten so painful he almost can't eat. Mrs. Ewing says he's living on eggnog, which won't hurt him a bit, of course. It's just fresh eggs and cream and sugar.
Beulah reached for a fresh pink towel.
Anyway, Doc Roberts told him if he wanted to get better, he had to stop singing for a while.
How unlucky, Verna exclaimed.
He's been with the Clovers forever.
He's really downcast, poor man, Beulah said sympathetically.
She wrapped the towel around Verna's head.
And, of course, it's put the Clovers in a terrible fix with the Dixie Regional coming up.
That's right, Verna said. Liz called me about bringing a pie for the pie supper afterward. I told her I would, but I haven't decided what kind to make.
She sat up.
So Hank is taking Mr. Ewing's place for the competition?
Yes, and now there's no living with him, Beulah chuckled.
He feels so lucky to be a Clover that his head has swelled up four sizes too large for his hat.
She took a pink hair-cutting cape off the shelf.
I told Liz I'd bring an apple pie. That red rebel tree in the backyard is positively loaded, and the squirrels and possums are already raiding it. I need to get out there and start picking.
Verna pushed herself out of the shampoo chair and headed over to Beulah's hair-cutting station.
Well, you tell Hank congratulations from me. I know he'll do a good job.
She sat down in front of the mirror. What songs are they doing in the competition?
They're trademark, of course, Beulah said.
She hummed a few bars of I'm Looking Over a Four-Leaf Clover as she shook out the cape and tied it around Verna's neck.
And I think they've decided on Yes, Sir, That's My Baby.
She glanced up at the clock.
Gosh, I'll get out. It's 8:20. I wonder what's keeping Bettina.
But just as she began to comb out Verna's wet hair, the door flew open and Bettina rushed in.
Sorry to be late.
she said breathlessly, whipping off her brown sweater and hanging it next to Verna's gray jacket. Something unexpected came up this morning.
That's all right, sweetie, Beulah said in a comforting tone. Bessie isn't here yet.
She nodded to the shelf where the electric coffee pot sat with cups and a plate of fresh oatmeal cookies.
If you didn't get your coffee, the pot's on. Help yourself. Have a cookie, too.
Thanks. I've already had breakfast, but another cup of coffee would be swell. Bettina straightened the collar of her pink and brown plaid cotton dress, then went to the coffee pot and began pouring the cup.
I am so sorry, Beulah. My phone isn't working or I would have called to say I'd be late.
Your phone, too? Verna asked.
It's our party line, Bettina said, sounding disgusted. It's out about half the time.
She added sugar to her coffee and stirred.
Anyway, I was just ready to walk out the door when Buddy stopped by to say he's working on a case and we'd better not figure on supper tonight. I told him that was a crying shame because I got up extra early and baked his favorite shoe fly pie for dessert. Seeing as how he hadn't had breakfast yet, he sat down and had a piece right quick.
She smiled a private little smile that implied that there was more to the story than she was telling. Beulah always tried to look past the surface and see the real beauty in people deep down, but even she had to say that Bettina, a tall, angular young woman with mousy brown hair and a face full of freckles, was not the prettiest flower in the garden. In fact, Beulah had worried that while Bettina had the soul of an artist when it came to hair and nails, she might be destined to dry up on the vine. It wasn't hard to end up an old maid these days, for matrimonial pickings were pretty slim. If a young man wanted a halfway decent job, he had to take the train to Memphis or Chicago, so most of Darling's eligible bachelors had left town. But to everybody's surprise, Bettina had caught the attention of one of the country's most marriageable men. He was Buddy Norris, who had recently been elected to fill the term vacated by the untimely death of Sheriff Roy Burns. Beulah picked up her comb and scissors and began to even up Verna's ends.
Well, at least Buddy got a piece of shoe fly pie before he went to work, she said, combing and snipping. That brings back memories. My grandma used to make shoe fly pie every Sunday morning. We had it for breakfast before we went to church. It was our special Sunday treat.
Verna turned her head so quickly that she almost got Beulah's scissors point in her eye.
How come Buddy had to cancel for supper, Bettina?
Careful, hon, Beulah said, using both hands to gently turn Verna's head back straight again.
Maybe it's not something Bettina can talk about.
Actually, I don't know. Bettina went to a cupboard and got out a clean pink and white checked apron. All he said was that it looked like he might have a pretty big case to work on, and he never likes to take time out from an investigation for personal reasons. She gave them a bright smile.
He may be just plain old Buddy Norris, but he's very professional.
There went Verna's head, swiveling again, and Beulah pulled it back, but this time Verna resisted.
Hold on a minute, Beulah, she said, turning her shoulders so she could look at Bettina. I want to know, Bettina, what's this about a pretty big case? What's going on?
Beulah rolled her eyes. That was so like Verna. She always had to know every single little detail and was never satisfied with an explanation. After what? Her next questions would be who and when and then why and how much will it cost? Which, of course, was an asset given her job as county treasurer. You wanted somebody at the courthouse who cared about keeping the record straight. Bettina frowned.
Somebody disappeared is all he said.
She tied her apron behind her back.
He didn't tell me the details. He just woofed down his pie and left.
Disappeared? That got Beulah's attention, and she turned, too.
You mean, like in ran away?
Or got kidnapped? Verna asked with interest.
Kidnapped? Oh, surely not, Verna.
Beulah was horrified at the thought. Not here in Darling.
I don't know why not, Verna said. It doesn't just happen in books, you know. They finally caught the man who kidnapped the Lindbergh baby, Bruno Hauptmann. That's real life for you, a lot more dangerous than fiction.
Bettina shuddered. I keep thinking about that sweet little Lindbergh baby, she murmured, and his poor mama and daddy.
Sad as sad can be, that's what it is.
And it's not just that baby, Verna went on, warming to her subject. People are getting kidnapped everywhere. Didn't you read that story in the Dispatch a couple of weeks ago? More than 2,000 people in this country were abducted and held for ransom in just the last 2 years. 2,000! Why, it's a crime wave. And it's happening in little towns and big cities everywhere. Nobody's safe.
Bettina's eyes were big.
You're right, Verna, she breathed.
All a crook has to do is grab you and tie you up and hide you in the coal shed or an abandoned cellar, she shuddered, and then send your relatives a note saying how many thousands of dollars they have to fork over or he'll kill you.
Thousands of dollars? Still combing and snipping, Beulah gave an ironic chuckle. That's why a crook would never bother to kidnap anybody in Darling, Bettina. People in this town have barely enough money to pay the rent and buy a week's groceries. You could turn all of us upside down and shake us, and you wouldn't get more than a pocket full of loose change.
Not everybody in this town is dead broke, Verna retorted. She gave a knowing sniff. Who do you suppose keeps businesses like Kilgore Motors alive? Some people have enough money to buy new cars.
Beulah turned to Bettina, feeling that they had done enough speculating and really ought to get down to brass tacks.
Did Buddy actually say somebody was kidnapped?
Bettina smoothed the wrinkles out of her apron.
Not specifically, no, she said. What he said was that somebody disappeared, which could mean almost anything, I guess. Somebody didn't get home after the movies last night, or got drunk and sleeping it off in a barn somewhere, or...
And he didn't say who it was? Verna asked, turning her head again. Or when, or how much...
Verna, sweetie?
Patiently, Beulah turned Verna's head straight and began to snip.
If you will just let me finish cutting you, you can go right over to the sheriff's office and ask Buddy yourself. If he won't tell you, walk down the block and ask Charlie Dickens. He's in the news business. If somebody's been kidnapped, he'll know who it is.
But Verna didn't have to wait until Beulah had finished cutting her, for at that moment, Bessie Bloodworth opened the door and came in. Short, heavy-set, and 50-something, Bessie had thick, dark eyebrows and loose salt-and-pepper curls that always looked must, as if she'd been combing them with her fingers. She was wearing a dark blue straw boater with a red ribbon and a navy cotton dress with a red rickrack border on a white sailor collar, which Beulah knew for a fact Bessie had bought from the Sears and Roebuck summer sale catalog for 99 cents, because she remembered seeing it there. Bessie didn't bother with her usual cheerful, "Hello," or "How is everybody this morning?" or even "I hope that coffee's hot." She just jumped right in with,
"Have you heard the news?"
From the tone of Bessie's voice, Beulah knew right away that it wasn't good news. Bessie, who owned and managed the Magnolia Manor, a boarding house for genteel elderly ladies, was Darling's resident historian. She knew everything there was to know about every single one of the local families, but she rarely bothered her head with current events. When Bessie announced gleefully that she had news, it was usually about something that had taken place 25 or 50 years before, and she had just dug it out of a letter or a newspaper clipping and couldn't wait to tell you about it so you could be as thrilled and excited as she was. All three of them turned to look at her.
"What news?"
Bettina asked nervously. Beulah paused in mid-snip.
"Has one of your ladies died?"
This was a continuing concern, since the Magnolia Manor residents were of advanced years and in varying stages of decrepitude.
"I guess you haven't heard, then."
Bessie took off her hat and headed for the coffee pot.
"No, we hadn't heard, Bessie," Verna said tartly, "but you obviously have. What's going on?"
Bessie picked up the pot and a cup and began to pour, still holding on to her news, but aware that her audience was getting annoyed. She gave them a hint.
"It's Whitney Whitworth."
"What about Mr. Whitworth, Bessie?" Beulah asked.
"Mr. Whitworth?" Bettina frowned. "Who is he?"
"Mr. Whitworth is the reason your party line is out of order, Bettina," Verna said crisply, "and why Beulah and I have no private lines."
"What?
Beulah and Bettina chorused at once, and Beulah added, "Just what are you saying, Verna?"
"It's a fact," Verna replied flatly. "Ask Myra May, she'll tell you. She has all these plans for modernizing our telephone system, but Whitney Whitworth owns 50% of the exchange, and he just flat refuses to chip in his share, which is a mystery to me since the Whitworths have plenty of money. Although," she added thoughtfully, "I understand that the money came from Mrs. Whitworth's side of the family, which I suppose might make some difference."
"Maybe not," Bessie said in an ironic tone. "Never having married, I'm no expert on husbands, but from what I hear, most of them think it's their responsibility to manage all the money in the family, regardless of where it comes from."
Bettina spoke up.
"Well, whoever's holding on to that money," she said plaintively, "I wish they'd turn loose of some of it. Can't somebody have a talk with Mr. Whitworth? He needs to know he's a stumbling block in the path of Darling's progress. I am ready to get my phone fixed any day now." She picked up a towel. "Come on, Miss Bessie, and we'll get started on your shampoo."
But Beulah still didn't have an answer to her question. Scissors poised, she glanced at Bessie.
"What about Mr. Whitworth, Bessie?" she repeated. "Has something happened to him?"
"I reckon you might say so," Bessie replied in a meaningful tone. She sat down in the shampoo chair.
"Roseanne heard from Desiree this morning that he didn't come home last night. The man has disappeared. Mrs. Whitworth is beside herself, of course. She's called the sheriff."
"Oh, my goodness," Beulah said.
"Well, Desiree should know."
Everybody else nodded. This was one of those situations where, if you understood who worked for whom in Darling, you would understand everything. Roseanne had cooked for Bessie at the manor for going on 10 years now. Desiree, a Creole from Louisiana, who had married Roseanne's second cousin, now passed on, worked for the Whitworths. Normally, Desiree and Roseanne wouldn't talk on the telephone during working hours, but as Bessie went on to explain it, the fact that Mr. Whitworth hadn't come home made this call an acceptable exception. Desiree had called to ask if Roseanne had any dried lemon balm so she could brew up some calming tea for poor Mrs. Whitworth, who was quite beside herself with worry. Roseanne had told Desiree that she didn't have any lemon balm, but she knew that Imogene did. Imogene cooked for Mrs. Foreignberry over on Cherry Street. Desiree should call over there and ask. Imogene had made up a little packet and sent it over by her husband Doobie, who had been pulling weeds out of Mrs. Foreignberry's petunias when he was sent on the errand. So by the time Desiree was able to brew Mrs. Whitworth some lemon balm tea, Roseanne, Imogene, and Doobie would have known that Mr. Whitworth hadn't come home the night before. An hour later, the number would have easily tripled or even quadrupled. It was well understood that if you wanted to find out what was really going on in town, you had to ask the help. The colored folks always know what's what. Although they always know how to keep a secret and who to tell it to, which most likely won't be their employers.
"Well, what did I say?" Verna demanded, then added smartly. "It's a kidnapping, that's what it is, and the Whitworths have plenty of money, even if most of it came from Mrs. Whitworth's side of the family. I wonder how much ransom the kidnappers are asking for him."
5 or 10,000 at least, I would think," Bessie said.
"How much did they ask for that lady that got kidnapped in Indianapolis?"
"They got 10,000 for her," Beulah said. "I read it in the paper."
"So that's why Buddy can't come to supper tonight," Bettina said, taking the cap off the shampoo bottle. "He's investigating a kidnapping. Well, I must say I'm surprised that such a thing could happen in little old Darling, but it's good to know what's going on."
She turned on the faucet in the sink and adjusted the temperature.
"You just put your head back, Miss Bessie, honey. You can tell us the rest of the story while you're getting beautiful."
Chapter 8. Buddy Norris Investigates. "Mr. Whitworth has disappeared?" Myra May asked blankly.
What's that supposed to mean, Buddy?
Buddy Norris sat down on his usual stool, the third one from the end, nearest the door, and folded his arms on the counter. Watching Myra May's face, he replied,
What I just said, Myra May. Whitney Whitworth didn't come home last night.
Casually, he added,
Don't suppose you know anything about it.
If she did, she wasn't letting on.
Don't know how come you're asking me,
she said, turning away to rearrange a pair of salt and pepper shakers.
Have you talked to his wife? She'd be the one to tell you where he is.
Buddy was disappointed. He had hoped that Myra May, who, after all, was Mr. Whitworth's business partner, might have some information.
Yes, I've talked to Mrs. Whitworth, he replied.
Regina Whitworth was a quiet lady, surprisingly young and rather attractive, who was rarely seen around town. In fact, Buddy could remember running into her only a couple of times before she had called him to her house just before 7 that morning. He added,
Do you reckon you could rustle me up a cup of coffee?
As Myra May went to the coffee urn, Buddy caught a glimpse of himself in the mirror behind the counter and brushed his brown hair back off his forehead. Roy Burns' nickel-plated sheriff star was pinned to the pocket of his khaki work shirt, which was about as close as he ever got to a uniform. People said that his cleft chin and wide forehead made him the spitting image of Charles Lindbergh, the famous airplane pilot who flew all the way to Paris and whose baby boy had been murdered by a kidnapper a couple of years before. Personally, Buddy thought he might look more like Lucky Lindy if he didn't have that scar across his cheek, which he'd got when Big Daddy Boudreaux got drunk and pulled a knife on him over at the Red Dog, a juke joint on the colored side of the L&N tracks. Big Daddy had slept it off in one of the town's 2 jail cells upstairs over Snow's farm supply, and Buddy let him go with a talking to the next morning. He didn't believe in holding a grudge against a man who was too drunk to know what he was doing, unless he did it a second time. Then it was time to take the matter seriously. Myra May slid a mug of coffee across the counter.
Have you had breakfast yet? Raylene might be able to round you up something. I had me a piece of shoe fly pie, Buddy said.
He half smiled as he remembered the thank you kiss he had bestowed on the girl who had baked the pie.
But if Raylene is still in the kitchen, I figure I might could get around some ham and...
This is for the sheriff, Raylene Riggs said, coming out of the kitchen with a plate of buttered toast and ham and eggs, soft and sunny side up, gently basted with hot bacon grease, just the way Buddy liked them. Myra May put the plate in front of Buddy and added silverware and a mug full of hot coffee.
There you are, Sheriff, she said. Now what's this about Mr. Whitworth?
Buddy appreciated the use of his new title. He'd grown up in this town, and his old man still lived a few blocks down on Robert E. Lee. Lots of people called him Buddy, like they did when he was a little kid, and like he was still wet behind the ears. He was glad that Myra May and Raylene weren't in that bunch.
I was hoping you could maybe shed some light on that, Buddy said. Either you or Violet.
Myra May raised her voice.
Hey, Violet, somebody wants to talk to you.
To Buddy, she said a little more sharply, What makes you think we know anything?
Just looking for some help is all.
Buddy raked his fork across one egg and sopped up the yellow yolk with a piece of buttered toast. Myra May's tone, he thought, was a little more challenging than usual.
For starters, he added mildly, I thought you or Violet might have heard something on the exchange or over the breakfast counter.
He smiled, being friendly.
You girls remind me of spiders in the middle of a web, you know. Something happens in Darling, you generally hear about it before anybody else.
It was true. Sheriff Burns used to say that the women who worked behind the counter at the diner were the best informed in town. And back when he was still just a deputy, Buddy had learned that when something happened, he could save a lot of time by sitting down with a cup of coffee and a piece of lemon meringue pie and asking Myra May and Violet what they knew about it. 9 times out of 10, they had picked up something he hadn't heard, just by listening to the conversations at the tables and the counter, or by being curious about a call that went through the exchange. Or, in Raylene's case, just by knowing however that worked, which Buddy didn't pretend to understand. Spiders, huh? Myra May gave him a slight smile that acknowledged the truth of what he had said, then shook her head.
But not this time, at least not so far as I'm aware.
She turned to Raylene.
You know anything about the whereabouts of Mr. Whitworth, Mama?
Can't say that I do, Raylene said in her rich, husky voice. She looked troubled. But I have to admit that I've never been able to tune into that man. He's different. Not like most other folks, you know.
Oh?
Buddy sopped up the last of the egg yolk. Different like how?
Everybody knew that Myra May's mother had the gift, as Buddy's grandmother had called it. For instance, Raylene could tell you what somebody wanted to eat before he ordered. She said it was like tuning a radio to a distant station. When people wanted something, they sent off a signal, loud if they wanted the thing a lot, soft if they were only so-so about it. When the signal was loud and her internal radio was working right, Raylene picked it up. When the signal was weak or she wasn't tuned in, she got a lot of static.
Different like how?
Buddy repeated, curiously. Raylene frowned.
He hides himself. On purpose.
Her frown deepened.
He's like, oh, I don't know, a tin can, maybe.
A tin can?
Buddy was interested. How's that?
Well, you know, Raylene waved her hand vaguely. All you've got to go by is the label somebody pasted on it, which may or may not be right. You can't see what's really inside.
Myra May chuckled.
What Mama is saying is that when Mr. Whitworth comes in here, which he doesn't very often, she never knows whether it'll be meatloaf or fried chicken. That bothers her.
Buddy reckoned that if you were in the psychic business, a tin can kind of person might be frustrating, but that wasn't helping him much since all he had to go by was the label. But what he needed was somebody who could tell him where Mr. Whitworth might be this morning and why he hadn't come home the night before.
Oh, hi, Buddy. What's going on?
He turned as Violet Sims came out of the exchange, which was in the spare room tacked on at the back of the diner. She was wearing a pretty blue and yellow cotton print dress, a yellow ribbon in her brown hair, and a yellow sweater with the sleeves pushed up to her elbows. As usual, her outfit was a sweet, girlish contrast to Myra May's red shirt and khaki slacks. Tilting her head, she smiled at him, and he returned the smile appreciatively. Violet held a special place in his heart, but he knew better than to let Myra May see how he felt. She was the jealous type.
What's going on is what the sheriff wants to know, Violet,
Myra May said.
Seems that Mr. Whitworth has disappeared.
Disappeared? Violet's eyes widened and her hand went to her mouth. You don't suppose somebody might have kidnapped him, do you?
What makes you say that? Buddy asked.
Well, everybody's getting kidnapped these days, aren't they? Violet said. I heard on the radio about a girl down in Mobile who got kidnapped just last week. She was ransomed for, I don't know how much, a lot.
$3,000, Raylene said.
Buddy whistled.
Whitney is one of the few people in this town who's rich enough to make it worthwhile to kidnap him,
Myra May said dryly.
They wouldn't get more than 2 bits if they kidnapped me.
Oh, come now, Myra May.
Violet objected. You know we'd scrape up every penny we could find.
I know you would, dear, Myra May replied sweetly. And if you shook out Cupcake's piggy bank, you might get as much as a whole dollar, if you're lucky.
Buddy forked up the last bite of ham and chewed. It was blanketed with Raylene's good red-eye gravy, which he would put up against anybody's in the world.
I was wondering whether you might have picked up anything on the exchange about Mr. Whitworth, he said. You know, somebody calling his house or mentioning his name or...
He let his voice trail off suggestively. Violet pursed her lips.
Nobody called his house, she said, and her glance slid to Myra May.
Anyway, we have our rules, you know.
Actually, it was Myra May's rule.
She was on record as saying that if she got wind of so much as one single shred of gossip that might have possibly come from the switchboard, she would fire the loose-lipped operator on the spot, no excuses accepted. But he also knew that listening in was pretty much unavoidable, since it was too much to ask any human being, let alone a 19-year-old girl, to sit in front of the switchboard for 8 hours a day with her headphones on without overhearing something. And since Myra May and Violet owned the switchboard, well, half of it anyway, they figured that listening was a little bonus they got with their investment. So they broke their rule whenever they found it convenient. Buddy put down his fork, feeling that it was a little difficult to conduct an official interrogation while you were enjoying ham and red-eye gravy. "I know you're not supposed to listen in," he said, "but you do. Sorry, ladies, but this is a police matter. Mr. Whitworth didn't come home last night. He still wasn't there when Mrs. Whitworth got up this morning, and she's pretty frantic. I am investigating this as a missing person case. I'd really appreciate you giving me a hand here." Myra May narrowed her eyes. "If you know anything, Violet, you might as well tell him." She slid a glance at Buddy. "We've got nothing to hide." Buddy wondered why Myra May thought she had to say that, but Violet was speaking. "Well, Lenore Looper was on the night shift, but I happened to be on the switchboard yesterday afternoon when Mr. Dunlap called Mr. Whitworth."
"And?"
Buddy prompted.
"Well, of course I..."
Buddy sighed. "And?" he repeated.
"And they agreed to get together at Mr. Dunlap's house yesterday evening. It was about the Clovers, as I remember. Something about Mr. Ewing having to drop out of the Clovers because he has pimples on his throat."
"That's unlucky," Myra May remarked. Buddy thought that this was probably unrelated.
"Anything else?"
Violet frowned.
"Well, there was a call this morning..."
"Buddy! Buddy! Buddy!"
cried Cupcake, running out of the exchange and careening toward him, laughing, arms flung wide.
"Jackie Jilfer up a hill!"
"Did he really now? That's pretty amazing."
Buddy reached down, scooped up the little girl, and nuzzled her neck. She was wearing pink corduroy bib overalls and smelled like talcum powder and roses. She wriggled with delight when he blew the curls on the back of her neck.
"And Humpty-Dumpty cracked his head."
She bounced on Buddy's knee, clapping her hands.
"That's enough, Cupcake," Violet said firmly, taking her out of Buddy's arms. "The sheriff is here on business."
Cupcake wrinkled her nose.
"One, two, buckle my shoelaces,"
she retorted with dignity.
"Three, four."
"I wonder if there's a good little girl who would like a glass of orange juice,"
Raylene remarked in a thoughtful tone.
"I'm sure if there is, we can find..."
"Me, me, me!"
Cupcake cried. Buddy set her on the floor, and she ran around the end of the counter. She and Raylene disappeared into the kitchen. Feeling the need to bring the conversation back to the central issue, Buddy took his notebook and a pencil out of his shirt pocket and looked at Violet. "You were saying something about a phone call this morning. Somebody called the Whitworth house?"
"Not so far as I know," Violet leaned against the counter. "It was Mrs. Whitworth calling Mr. Mosley's office. I stayed on the line until Liz Lacey answered, because I wasn't sure she'd got to work yet. Liz had just left here with one of Raylene's cinnamon sugar donuts. They're her favorite."
She turned to Myra May.
"Myra May, you might tell Raylene they're all gone so she can..."
Buddy cleared his throat.
"Sorry,"
Violet muttered.
"Anyway, I stayed on the line, but just long enough to hear Liz answer and Mrs. Whitworth say she had to speak to Mr. Mosley. That's when I got off."
"You didn't hear anything else?" Violet hesitated.
"Only that Mr. Mosley was doing a deposition in Montgomery and wouldn't be back for a couple of days."
"Deposition," Buddy wrote. "Montgomery." He wondered why Mrs. Whitworth was calling a lawyer. "Anything else?"
"Well, it seemed like Mrs. Whitworth was pretty upset.
She must have really wanted to talk to Mr. Mosley because she called him long distance. But, of course, I got off the line as soon as they were connected. Upset, long distance. Buddy had the feeling there was more. And then? Violet sighed. And then Mr. Mosley called his office, long distance again, and talked to Liz. But I didn't hear anything they said, and that's all, she added with a note of finality. Honest. All that calling back and forth happened this morning? Buddy asked. Violet nodded. Sometime after 8, because Lenore had just gone home. She worked the board last night, so if you want to know anything about that, you'll have to ask her.
Thanks, Buddy said. I will.
He looked at Myra May.
I'm wondering when was the last time you talked to him? To Mr. Whitworth, I mean.
Me?
Myra May raised an eyebrow.
You're asking because...
Because you're his business partner, Buddy replied. Because I'll be talking to his other business partner, and some more folks, too,
he added, because to tell the truth, he wasn't exactly sure who he would be talking to. He had never investigated a missing person before, and Mrs. Whitworth had been too upset to give him any good leads. She was genuinely frightened, he had thought. All she could do was cry and wring her hands, so pale and hysterical that he'd thought she was maybe going to faint on him, and he sure as hell didn't know what to do about that. He had left in kind of a hurry.
Well, he prompted after a minute.
Violet looked at Myra May. Myra May looked at Violet, shifted and frowned.
Yesterday. I talked to him yesterday.
Buddy made a note. Morning, afternoon, evening. A pause.
Afternoon, Myra May said guardedly.
Here?
Upstairs, so we wouldn't be disturbed.
I was there, too, Violet added helpfully.
Buddy scribbled some more.
What did you talk about?
Myra May sighed heavily.
What we always talk about with that man. How important it is to expand the switchboard. How many people will benefit. How much money we'll save.
Buddy raised his eyebrows. It sounded like a normal kind of business discussion to him.
And he said, he prompted.
No,
Myra May said darkly.
He said no again.
She means, Violet explained, that this is an ongoing discussion. We have to expand the exchange. Myra May has picked out the equipment that will do the job, and we've got enough money to cover our share of the cost. But Mr. Whitworth keeps saying no. He says he's what's called a limited partner, which means he only put the money into the business at the beginning. He doesn't have to put in anything else.
Which is just nuts,
Myra May scowled darkly.
We know he must have the money, but every time we ask, he just flat refuses. We've tried to buy him out of his damned 50%, but he's asking so much we can't afford it, so we're stuck.
Must be frustrating, Buddy said. He could see their point of view.
We're not the only ones who have this problem, Violet added. Reginald Dunlap at the Five and Dime, Mr. Whitworth is partners with him, too, and there may be others.
Frowning, Buddy scribbled faster. Reginald Dunlap, D-U-N-L-O-P.
He wasn't much of a speller, especially when it came to names.
Others? Like who?
You don't know that for a fact, Violet, Myra May said cautiously. That's just Mr. Dunlap's notion.
But it's something Buddy should know, Violet protested.
To him, she added, Mr. Dunlap says Mr. Whitworth owns a share of Bodine Pyle's whiskey still.
Buddy wasn't sure he believed it, but he wrote the name down anyway, Bodine Pyle.
Thank you, he said. Anybody else? How about friends? Do you know who his friends are?
Violet and Myra May exchanged looks. Myra May shrugged.
Maybe the Clovers?
Violet hazarded.
Okay.
Buddy wrote that down.
How about places Mr. Whitworth might go, people he might want to see, if he left Darling, I mean?
Myra May looked at him.
Has he left Darling? Did he take his car?
His car. Feeling the flush climb his cheeks, Buddy folded his notebook and stood.
What do I owe you for breakfast?
It's on the house, Myra May said. You're doing your duty. We want to help.
Thank you, Buddy replied humbly. Why in tarnation hadn't he thought to ask Mrs. Whitworth whether her husband's car was gone, too? It was because she was crying, that's why. Roy Burns would never have made that mistake. He had to learn how to handle weeping females, or he'd never be able to do his job.
Humpty dumpty,
Cupcake announced loudly and with great seriousness in the kitchen.
Jackie Jill pushed him down the hill and he broke his head.
At the rear of the diner, a young woman stepped out of the door of the exchange.
Is Sheriff Norris here? She asked.
Buddy turned, surprised.
Present?
He said, realizing that she must be the other switchboard operator on duty this morning.
You've got a phone call, the girl replied. He says he's your deputy.
You can take it at the switchboard, Buddy, Violet said. Come on, I'll show you.
Buddy grinned. Far as he was concerned, Violet could call him Buddy any day of the week. The exchange was a narrow room, with the telephone switchboard on one side and a cot for the nighttime operator on the other. Buddy had never seen a switchboard before and was surprised at its complexity. The thing was a 4-by-6-foot vertical panel with rows of lighted sockets and a horizontal board with plugs and jacks. The operator, wearing what looked like earmuffs over her head and a funnel-shaped mouthpiece around her neck, sat in front of this contraption and plugged the right jack into the right socket. It all looked very advanced and mysterious to Buddy, but he could see one thing at a glance. It really was quite easy for the operator to hear every word that anybody said, or, to put it a different way, it was hard not to hear. Violet handed him a headset and inserted a plug into a blinking socket on the switchboard.
You're connected. You can talk.
Yo, Wayne, Buddy said into the funnel. What's up?
The man on the other end was Wayne Springer, Cypress County's new deputy. The sheriff's office was only a 2-man shop, and when Buddy won the special election to fill Roy Burns' empty boots, somebody had to fill his. Wayne came with 5 years of experience as a deputy over in Jefferson County, where his training had included target practice with the 38 Special, which was one of the reasons Buddy had hired him. Buddy could shoot a squirrel out of his dad's peach tree with his .22 rifle, but he still wasn't comfortable with the notion that he might actually have to shoot somebody with the revolver he sometimes carried on his hip, which is why he didn't carry it more often. The other reason Buddy had hired Wayne was that he was from way over by Birmingham. Jobs were hard to get, and there had been a dozen would-be deputies, but Wayne was the only one with no local kinfolk. Buddy reasoned that if you and your deputy were in a tight spot, you didn't want him wondering whether the man they had cornered up in the barn loft was his mother's favorite cousin's son. The deputy might hold his fire, or conversely, and just as likely, he might shoot when he didn't need to. In Buddy's opinion, a stranger was more likely to be objective when it came to apprehending people. Buddy listened to the tale Wayne was telling him on the phone.
Well, that's a bad hill when it's muddy, he said. Several accidents there in the past. Where are you now?
He listened some more, then said, Spook Hill is out on the Jericho Road. You want to go past the airfield a good mile, maybe mile and a half.
I'm going over to the 5 and Dime and see Mr. Dunlap about this Whitworth thing. You reckon you can handle that accident without me?
He listened to Wayne's reply, feeling grateful that his deputy had enough experience to be confident in dealing with just about anything.
Nothing from Mrs. Whitworth, he asked. No ransom calls yet?
He nodded.
Right. Okay. See you later.
He handed Violet the telephone gear.
Thanks, he said. Sorry for the interruption.
Violet pulled the plug.
Myra May can be a little abrupt, she said softly. But she wants to help. She really does.
I know she'll worry about Mr. Whitworth until she hears he's okay, so let us know as soon as you've located him. He is our partner, after all. She wants another chance at convincing him to help us modernize. She paused, frowning. No ransom calls?
Nope.
Buddy had the feeling there wouldn't be. What do you suppose has happened to him?
Hard to say, Buddy replied thoughtfully. Sometimes folks just get a little tired of the life they're living, and they chuck it and take off for parts unknown.
He grinned.
Or a guy gets a little drunk and knows his missus is waiting up for him and doesn't want her to see him in that condition, so he goes someplace to sleep it off.
Violet looked doubtful. That doesn't sound much like Mr. Whitworth. I don't know him that well, but he's never struck me as the type to get so drunk he can't make it home.
Well, don't you worry your pretty head about it, Buddy said expansively, resisting the urge to give Violet a quick kiss on the cheek. We'll get it straightened out.
But Buddy wasn't as confident as he liked to pretend. He hadn't thought to ask about the car, a dumb mistake, the kind an amateur would make. And he couldn't quite put his finger on it, but there had been something about his conversation with the tearful Mrs. Whitworth early that morning that had made him uncomfortable. He wasn't sure she was telling him the truth, at least not all the truth. But he didn't give a lot of credence to Violet's idea of a kidnapping. For one thing, there hadn't been a ransom demand, at least not yet. Wouldn't kidnappers holding a man as well off as Mr. Whitworth start calling first thing? And there was Raylene's puzzling remark about the tin can. Since he'd been sheriff, Buddy had run into more tin cans than he would have thought possible here in Little Darling. People who were labeled one thing on the outside and were entirely something else when you managed to pry the lid off. He was often surprised at the number of secret lives that were lived in such a little town.
He hides himself, Raylene had said, on purpose.
If Whitney Whitworth wanted to hide himself, that is, actually hide himself, where was he likely to go?
Chapter 9. Lizzie Makes a Discovery. Lizzie loved to walk, especially on a pretty October morning when the air was so crisp that just breathing it made you feel fizzy and the sugar maple leaves blazed like somebody had put a match to them. Of course, Darling was small enough that you could walk anywhere you wanted to go in a half hour or less, and if you had to go any farther, a bicycle was as good as a car. In this case, she had to walk only 6 or 7 blocks. She cut across the courthouse lawn and went past the old Alabama Hotel, which served the most elegant meals in town, with Mrs. LaVaughn playing soft dinner music on the grand piano in the lobby. Past Pete's Pool Parlor, with its outdoor barbecue barrel belching fragrant smoke and somebody breaking a rack of balls with a crack loud enough to be heard on the street. Past Brady's Barbershop, haircuts 2 bits, its signboard plastered with Huey P. Long's grinning picture and the words, "Every man's a king," in big black letters. Somebody had drawn a crown on the senator's head and penciled in, "Vote for Huey." And then, as Lizzie passed Kilgore Motors' showroom window, she saw that the jazzy pumpkin-colored 1934 Dodge convertible coupe that had been there the week before was gone, replaced by a sedate black Dodge sedan. The coupe must have been sold, she realized, with a pang. She didn't actually need a car, and she certainly couldn't afford one, not with her job in jeopardy. But that didn't keep her from admiring the swell-looking convertible and wondering who had bought it. And who was getting the free driving lessons from Frank Harwood? Must be somebody who lived out of town, she decided, since she hadn't seen anyone driving it. Lizzie had almost reached Mimosa Street when she saw Grady Alexander's old blue Ford coming up Robert E. Lee toward her. If there'd been a store she could duck into, she would have. But there wasn't. He slowed, and she thought he intended to pull over to the curb and stop. To prevent him, she pointed to her wristwatch and shook her head, pantomiming apology. He gave a regretful shrug, waved, and mouthed, "I'll call you," before he drove on. Lizzie felt as if she had dodged a bullet somehow, although she couldn't have said exactly what that meant. She just knew that she didn't know what she was going to do about Grady, and the uncertainty was at once unsettling and intriguing. She took a relieved breath and went on. Usually, Lizzie took her time when she walked, especially this time of year. She enjoyed the golden marigolds and purple fall asters and orange chrysanthemums that bloomed in the small front yards, and the fire engine red geraniums that decorated the porches. Life had been tough in Darling, and while things were looking up, people hadn't forgotten their hard-learned lessons of self-reliance and frugality. She turned the corner onto Mimosa Street, where almost everybody had a garden. Fresh collards and snap peas in the spring, sweet corn and green beans and tomatoes in the summer, sweet potatoes in the fall. Most folks also kept a dozen hens and a rooster in a backyard coop, so they could have eggs for breakfast and chicken and dumplings for Sunday dinner. But while the morning air was enticing and the neighborhood was pleasant, Lizzie moved along briskly. For one thing, there was nobody in the office to answer the telephone, so she ought to get back to her desk as quickly as she could. For another, she was prickling with curiosity about what was going on. She kept thinking of those notes she had typed that morning, for they were notes of Mr. Mosley's discussion with Mrs. Whitworth. Scrupulously, Lizzie had directed her attention elsewhere while she typed. Still, she couldn't miss the general drift, which would certainly raise a Darling eyebrow or two. According to the notes, Mrs. Whitworth suspected her husband of misusing the money she had inherited from her grandmother just before she got married. The timing was important. In Alabama, any money a woman inherited before she got married belonged legally to her and not to her husband. Mrs. Whitworth wanted Mr. Mosley to look into the situation, find out what had happened, and advise her about what she could do, if anything. When he had asked, "Are you thinking about divorce?" she had answered emphatically, "I don't have to consider it. I've already made up my mind. I'm going to divorce Whitney." For Darling, this was a sensationally scandalous declaration. If people knew, their party lines would be buzzing with excitement, assuming their party lines were operating, that is. The Whitworth home was on Peachtree. It was a substantial brick house with white pillars across the front and green painted shutters at the windows, set back from the street by a well-tended yard studded with live oaks. A graveled drive led to a two-car garage at the back. The house wasn't as palatial as some of the plantation homes Lizzie had visited, but for Darling, it was impressive. Lizzie climbed the front steps to the green painted front door and rang the doorbell. A moment later, its chime was answered by a thin-faced, angular woman of indeterminate age, with skin the color of dark chocolate and graying hair in tight curls all over her head. She wore a black maid's uniform with a frilly white collar and a white apron. When she saw Lizzie, her face broke in a wide smile and her dark eyes flashed with pleasure. "Miss Lizbeth, good morning." "Why, hello, Desiree. It's good to see you. How are you this morning?" Lizzie was surprised, and then she wasn't. She remembered hearing that after old Miss Hamer died a few months before, her maid, Desiree, had been hired by Mrs. Whitworth for day work, cooking, and cleaning. Growing up, Lizzie had been under the benevolent charge of Sally Lou Hawkins, a colored girl who had been more of a friend and companion than a nanny, and who, once her young charge was grown up, had stayed on as a maid to Lizzie's mother. Sally Lou had become a member of the Lacey family, and Desiree, Sally Lou's auntie by marriage, had visited so often that she was like family once removed. Lizzie still had fond memories of going into the kitchen after she finished her homework and finding Sally Lou and Desiree laughing together over slices of red velvet cake and cups of tea. Often she would walk with Sally Lou over to Maysville to visit Desiree, finding her dressed in one of her colorful Creole outfits, stirring up a pot of spicy sausage and okra gumbo, big enough to share with all her neighbors. She would never forget the tiny kitchen that smelled of wood smoke and hot lard and had a slanted floor that was perfect for marble racing with Sally Lou's kid brother, Freeman, a year older than Lizzie. "I's fine," Desiree replied to Lizzie's question.
She threw a quick glance over her shoulder and leaned forward, lowering her voice. She spoke with a strong Cajun accent that sometimes made her difficult to understand. "But Miss Whitworth ain't just real good, I'm sorry to say. You might ought to come back when she's feeling better."
Lizzie shook her head. "I'm sorry, but I need to see her, Desiree. I work for her."